Welcome to the spirituality.org.za podcast. Right, well, today is the 5th of July, 2005, and you're listening to a podcast on www.spirituality.org.za. Well, since the last time I brought this podcast, there have been a number of positive changes that I hope you will be able to make use of and appreciate. The first one is that today I'm podcasting with a brand new audio rig. I went and bought myself a Eurorack UB802 Behringer mixing desk, and I'm using my Sennheiser microphone. It's an 835, Sennheiser 835S, and I'm hoping that the sound quality is going to be a bit better than the last time that the pod show was brought to you, the podcast. And the last time I brought it to you, it was simply recorded using the internal microphone on my 12-inch Apple PowerBook, a 1.33 gigahertz PowerBook, and now I've got the audio in on the line in. I'll try it also with my Belkin iMic at some stage just to see whether that gives better sound quality, but for now it seems to be quite good. Well, on today's show we will be discussing a paper that I gave recently at the Theological Society of Southern Africa meetings. That was held in Stellenbosch from the 22nd to the 24th of July, and the meeting, the theme of the Theological Society meeting was healing and wholeness. So hang on for 1 second. I'm just going to get that paper and then I'll be right back with you. Right, so here I am back with you again. Now, the paper itself was entitled SQ, which stands for Spiritual Quotient, A Key to Wellness and Wholeness, and in particular, the title of the paper that I presented was Spiritual Quotient as a Neurotheological Key to Wellness and Wholeness. And the interesting thing is that research in both science and theology has begun to move away from views of human beings as being merely mechanistic towards approaches that emphasize an interaction and an interrelationship between the various systems of human being. And so the aim of the paper that I presented was to discuss some of the implications that intelligence, human intelligence, and in particular spiritual intelligence, which is a fairly new subject, may have upon the wellness of a person as a whole living being. The paper will start with a discussion of the three primary systems that constitute a whole person. There will be some insight into the functioning of the human brain. So if you know a little bit about that, you can drop me a line. I'm always happy to hear from people. This will be followed by a presentation of the three dominant forms of intelligence, IQ, EQ, and SQ, intellectual quotient, emotional quotient, and spiritual quotient. And these particular forms of intelligence are normally identified through a study of the functioning of the brain as a whole. Some time will be spent looking at the theological, neurotheological implications of spiritual intelligence, and then some time looking at how one can develop that form of intelligence. It was Max Planck, the scientist, who once said that science cannot solve the ultimate mystery of nature, because in the last analysis, we are part of the mystery that we are trying to solve. And so let me say right at the outset that what I'm presenting here is not an epistemic study of the functioning of the brain. Rather, I've taken the research of others, and my aim is to interpret that phenomenologically and to draw some theological conclusions from that. The first thing that needs to be mentioned is that research in science and theology has begun to move away from a mechanistic view of the human person towards approaches that emphasize the interaction of the various systems of human being. And in particular, the reductionist method of Western medicine has been called into question in some ways. For those who are not all that familiar with where reductionism and mechanism comes from, and the materialist worldview, it would be interesting to go and read a little bit about René Descartes. He was the philosopher who said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, locating the essence of being within the thought processes of the individual. And then, of course, Sir Isaac Newton, who was the one who developed a mathematical method to describe the motion of solid bodies. And he believed that all of nature and creation can be described in terms of a number of laws, such as gravity, the one that we perhaps know best. This mechanistic worldview or reductionist worldview had left its imprint upon particularly Western society. Think about this for a moment. When we come to treat a person who is not well, instead of dealing with a person as a whole, we tend to deal only with what we believe to be the part that is injured. So we don't treat people, we tend to treat sore backs or bad headaches. And we very often forget that the human person as a whole is interconnected. And such reductionist views, just dealing with a sore back, is not enough, because very often the cause of the sore back is tension that's resulted from stress at work that's causing the muscles in the back to contract. And so the realization is that what is required for total wholeness and well-being is an approach which takes account of every aspect of human being, the physical, the spiritual, and the psychological. And so this particular paper wants to deal with the understanding that the spiritual element of human being is an essential element to wholeness. Now, let me say a couple of words, having understood that the human person is comprised of three primary systems, the physical, the psychological, and the spiritual. Let me go on to say a few things about the functioning of the human brain. McCrone writes that the purpose of the human brain is to optimize behavior, to juggle the body's needs against the threats and possibilities of the moment. And the truth is that the human brain is that aspect of the human person through which our consciousness is channeled and our actions and reactions are shaped. Now, for those who are not too familiar with the human brain, the brain consists basically of the same makeup as that of an ordinary cell in the human body. And we know that each cell has the ability to secrete and respond to chemical messages, and that there's a natural charge within every cell in the human body that is a difference between the inside and the outside. And that difference in charge is what allows every cell in the body to conduct electricity throughout it. So the brain signaling is pretty much the same. In essence, the brain is made up of cells, which are called neurons, and these function in the same way. They're just stretched out compared to any other cell in the body, and they basically conduct electricity. The human brain has between, what would that be? That would be 10 billion and 100 billion neural cells. Now, a typical neuron is shaped like a tree with roots, which are called dendrites, a cell body, and a trunk and branches, which are the axon terminals. And each neuron, each of these cells, receives sensory inputs to its dendrites, which can stimulate or inhibit it. So the functioning is either to stimulate or inhibit the movement of the electricity through these cells. And these inputs travel towards the cell body, fading as they go. And if enough stimulus reaches a cell body at any given moment, it fires an action potential along the axon terminals. And these axon terminals in turn form synapses or junctions on the dendrites with neighboring neurons. And when these neurons connect together, they are the aspect of the human brain which causes it to function in a certain way. Now, we know that in essence, most drugs function by either stimulating or inhibiting the function of the transfer of electricity or neurological transmitters within the brain. So, for example, a person who has too little noradrenaline may be a person who suffers from depression. A person who has a lot of adrenaline may be someone who is hyperactive. And so these particular chemicals also stimulate or inhibit the functioning of the brain. Now, what scientists have done with this is they've developed certain technologies that allow them to measure how and where the cells in the brain fire in relation to certain stimuli. So, for example, you have instances where a person may be exposed to a certain kind of experience or an image, or be asked to move a part of their body, like a hand, and then a machine called a magnetoencephalograph, which is basically just a very, very sensitive measuring tool, which is placed on the head of the person, on the skull of the person, measures where the electrical activity is taking place. From the data which is received from that, one can map in the brain exactly where it is that the person is stimulated, and what sections of the brain work together, which sections are inhibited and which sections are stimulated. Now, obviously, that can offer some valuable insight into where it is that certain pathologies and struggles come from. It can allow us to understand why and how it is that a person responds in a particular way to a certain stimulus, whether it's pathological, so problematic, or whether it's something that one wishes to try and help the person to develop. Now, when the brain is studied in this way, one can see that there are basically three particular ways or three types of intelligence that one can see by studying the activity of the brain. And most of what I'm going to be speaking about today comes from two sources. The first source is a book by Dana Zohar and Ian Marshall, which was written in the year 2000, and it's called SQ. The second book is a book by Andrew Newberg and Eugene de Aquilae called The Mystical Mind, Probing the Biology of Religious Consciousness, and that was published in 1999. If you would like full titles, drop me an email, digitaldion, digitaldion@gmail.com. You can find the link on the blog. Now, the three types of intelligence that one can see by studying the brain are, first of all, the IQ, or intellectual quotient. The second is EQ, the emotional quotient. And the third is SQ. Now, let's have a look, first of all, at IQ. A great deal has been written about IQ. And in fact, this particular form of intelligence at one stage was regarded as the only intelligence that a person has. However, it's become clear that when we look at intelligence, there's far more than just the linear thought processes. Now, IQ has to do with the linear wiring of neurological functions, and it very much has to do with our understanding of arithmetic, Aristotelian logic, things like 1 plus 1 equals 2, and the brain behaves in a very, very certain and particular way. The learning that's involved with this kind of serial thinking, intellectual quotient, is accurate, it's precise, and it's reliable. The problem with this kind of learning is that it really understands the rules. It learns to operate according to the rules. 1 plus 1 will always equal 2. But it finds it very difficult to be effective when the rules are changed. And the other thing is that this kind of learning seems to be, or this kind of functioning of the brain or facility of the brain seems to be, a preset which cannot be very easily trained. These neural tracks exist and they operate in that particular way. So they're rigid, they help us to do certain things, but they're difficult to amend. The second kind of learning that, or second kind of intelligence that's identified through the study of the brain, is a kind of intelligence called EQ. And this is the one that forms the link between emotions and the environment. It enables us to identify patterns and make associations with those particular patterns, such as faces or smells, to learn bodily skills like riding a bicycle. An EQ is often referred to as the body's intelligence. It's normally affected by gifted athletes or musicians who've practiced painstakingly the task that they're going to do. Now, each of the network bundles that is present here, it's not a linear wiring, so not in linear. These are parallel processes. They group together different sets of neurons, and they can have up to 100,000 neurons in each bundle connected to thousands of similar neurons. Now, the next important thing to note about EQ is that very often EQ is a conditioned response. For example, one of the best known applications of EQ is the well-known understanding of Pavlov's dogs, where the animals learned to salivate at the sound of the bell after they had had food presented to them together with the bell. So the association of the bell and the behavior that comes from it is a learned experience. The input matches in some way what comes from the output. Another way of explaining this or illustrating it is if a rat runs a maze. And when it runs a maze, it doesn't use IQ as much as it uses EQ. It doesn't learn the rules as such because the maze changes constantly. And so what the rat does is if a trial run fails, no neural connection is made for that run. However, if it succeeds, the neural connection is made. And if the rat has an opportunity to run the same maze again and again, that neural connection will be strengthened. And so the more often we perform a particular associative action in a certain way, the stronger the neural connections come. And so this can be likened in some way to riding a bicycle. You know, there's no way to read a manual or the rules of riding a bicycle and simply ride. You actually have to allow your body to feel your way through your forward trajectory, how much speed is needed to keep you upright, etc. And so Zohar comments on EQ saying we feel our skills, we do our skills, but very often with EQ, we don't think or talk about them. Someone, when I presented the paper, spoke about this and said that this can be likened to a golf player who manages to get their golf swing right. Yet when you ask them to explain what it is that they've done to get it right, they very often can't describe it. An interesting experiment was done in 1993. Seymour and Norwood described what lay behind the experiment. Experts and beginners in chess were shown a series of common chess positions. Some of them were good chess moves, and some of them were nonsensical. The outcome of the experiment was when they got them to retrace all of the moves, the experts were much better than the novices at reproducing the common places. You see, years of play in chess had firmly associated the neural networks. What works, what is right, had been firmly connected through their experience. Whereas both groups performed equally badly at reproducing the nonsensical positions, since both had to apply linear neural connections, serial logical thinking, IQ, to these positions. So a chess grandmaster, it was found, has over the years built up an associative pattern of some of close to 50,000 types of chess positions. So when this person is confronted, a chess grandmaster, with a situation in actual play, he doesn't have to reanalyze IQ, linear connection, logic, all of the positions, calculating serially the consequences of each move. He instantly recognizes a promising move through prior success and then applies his serial rational analyses to those moves. A novice player, on the other hand, has to analyze every possibility and move every piece from scratch without any association. So we can understand, certainly for business application, this kind of EQ, and this is where Daniel Goleman's book on EQ has been so useful and has taken off within the business environment. Now let's move on to SQ, spiritual quotient, and this is the brain's unit of thinking. Goleman's Emotional Intelligence, 1996, said a great deal about this, but until recently, very little had been written about spiritual quotient. Zohar defines SQ, or spiritual quotient, as the intelligence with which we address and solve problems of meaning and value. It's the intelligence with which we can place our actions and our lives in a wider, richer, meaning-giving context. The intelligence with which we can assess that one course of action, or that one life path, is more meaningful than the other. Now, someone described this to me very succinctly when they said, IQ allows us, linear intelligence, intellectual quotient, allows us to learn the rules well. EQ allows us to learn how to respond appropriately within the rules. When we encounter a certain situation, how to respond best and appropriately. SQ is a transcendent form of intelligence. It not only allows us to understand how to operate with the rules, how to operate within the rules, but it allows us the opportunity to ask the question, are the rules appropriate at all? You see, it transcends the boundaries. Now, there's a fair amount of scientific evidence for the existence of this kind of intelligence. Firstly, there's Persinger and Ramachandran's research into the God spot in the human brain, and it's been shown that there is a built-in spiritual center located amongst the neural connections in the temporal lobes of the brain. Essentially, its scans were taken with positron emission tomography, and they showed up neural activity whenever subjects were exposed to spiritual or religious experience. The God spot does not prove the existence of God. However, as Quillay and Newberg believe, it shows us that humans have evolved to deal with existential and ontological religious questions. The second piece of significant work with in relation to spiritual intelligence comes from Wolf Singer's research in the 90s that showed that the brain devoted a large section of its activity to unifying and meaning-giving experience. And this is a process that literally binds together our EQ and our IQ. In short, Singer discovered that whenever the brain was stimulated, the neurons involved in the process of the stimulation would resonate or oscillate at a frequency of 40 hertz, while those that were not involved would not oscillate in union. In effect, the 40 hertz unit of oscillations are the basis of consciousness in the brain. They're what link and give meaning to individual responses and stimuli. They unify the linear and associative intelligence and offer a wider meaning into the stimulant or experience. The third area of research comes from Rodolfo Linus's work, which builds on Singer's and uses the magnetoencephalograph scans, and it allows for an understanding not only of particular areas in the brain, but to be able to see how the different unitive stimulants across the brain draw together to offer some insight into spiritual intelligence. The last is Terence Deacon's research on the brain's symbolic meaning-centered activity. And Terence Deacon pointed out some interesting things. He said that one of the primary functions of the human brain is to search for higher meaning. And in fact, he went so far as to say that the production of language was a response to that search for meaning, not only to communicate meaning, but also to be able to hear from others, to allow others to communicate meaning to us. And so that is very much a transcendent function. So one may ask, what use is SQ to the human person? Well, Viktor Frankl once said that the human search for meaning is the primary motivation in his life, and it's not a secondary rationalization of instinctual drives. This meaning is unique and specific in that it must and can be fulfilled by the person alone. And then, only then does it achieve the significance which will satisfy his own will to meaning. So effectively, SQ helps us to deal with existential and ontological challenges, problems that leave us feeling personally stuck, trapped by our own past habits, our neuroses, our problems with illness, with grief. All of these things can be dealt with by using SQ. SQ allows us to recognize these problems, and instead of just living within them, as EQ would suggest, It enables us to find ways to transcend them and solve them. SQ is our compass and our conscience. In essence, every single person forms a view of reality through a combination of experience and vision, that which we are and that which we dream of becoming. A person with a high SQ is able to look beyond their own selfish ego needs and find a deeper fulfillment. SQ can also help us to wrestle with some of the problems of good and evil, fulfillment and disappointment, suffering and hope. And Zohar notes that too often we either try to rationalize these problems away, in other words, within the laws, instead of dealing with them and growing through them. At the other end, we become emotionally swamped by them. One of my favorite quotes comes from the Jewish mystic Rabbi Abraham Herschel, who said, "We are closer to God when we are asking questions than when we think we have the answers." Now, here is a short list of some of the indications of a person who has a highly developed SQ. And please note that SQ is not necessarily associated with any structured form of religion. Certainly, there are many people who are very committed members of certain faiths who have a low SQ. They have very little transcendence. They live in terms of EQ within the boundaries of their faith. Or some relate only in terms of IQ. They have no transcendent element. Then you have other persons who have no particular faith relationship with a particular structured or formalized religion who have a high SQ. So here are some indicators of a highly developed SQ. Firstly, the capacity to be flexible, actively and spontaneously adaptive, a high degree of self-awareness, a capacity to face disappointment and suffering, the capacity to face and transcend pain, the quality of being inspired by the visions and values, a reluctance to cause unnecessary harm, a tendency to see other connections between diverse things, i.e. what is referred to as the holistic operators. And you can read more about that in De Quillay and Newberg's research. And by the way, a full copy or transcript of this paper is available on the website at http://www.spirituality.org.za/blogger, blogger.html, or go to the spirituality.org.za main page and click on the news link, and you can find a full transcript of this paper. So Zohar sums up by saying, a person high in SQ is likely to be a servant leader, someone who is responsible for bringing higher vision and value to others and showing them how to use it. In other words, a person who inspires others. And so I want to conclude by saying, if SQ is such a valuable aspect of human being, then one needs to find ways to improve it. And it's worth noting, friends, that we live in a spiritually dumb culture that's characterized by individualism, materialism, expediency, lack of meaning, and a dearth of commitment. We can, however, raise our SQ and that of those persons around us by using tertiary processes. Our tendency to ask why, quoting Zohar, to look for connections between things, to bring to the surface the assumptions that we have been making about the meaning behind and within things, to become far more reflective, to reach beyond ourselves a little and to take responsibility, to become more self-aware and to become honest with ourselves and more courageous. Well, friends, that's the presentation on SQ. I hope that you find some use in it, and if you do, I'd love to hear from you. Drop me a line on digitaldion@gmail.com. There is a link on the website. It's digitaldion@gmail.com. Thanks for listening today, and I hope you come back again soon. Bye.